The Sedra starts, Vayakel Moshe, Eskol Adas B'nei Yisrael. In order for the Mishkan to be operable, there had to be Achdus in Klal Yisrael. The whole Mishkan put everything together. It was like a little universe. And that's why Klal Yisrael got that Achdus around the Mishkan. They were made into Golem. Everybody became a part of a Tzibur, of a unified nation, with the Mishkan as its center. There are three kinds of Tzibur: Kahal, Eda, and Yisrael. That's what it says. Vayakel Moshe is the Kahal, Kol Adas, the Eda, and Yisrael. We find that by Korban Pesach also. Korban Pesach is brought Kahal, Adas, Yisrael. And we learn from there that you have to bring Korban Pesach in three groups of ten. The Kahal, the Eda, and Yisrael. And there's a machlokus whether it means three groups of ten at one time, 30 people, or three separate groups of ten, and therefore we bring in the Korban Pesach in three groups of 30 minimum. 3 times 30. In case that you need the three tens together, or the three tens separately. Okay, whatever. But there's this concept of Kahal Adas Yisrael. And I think they represent three kinds of unity. Kahal, as it says in Megillas Esther, Vayikohalu HaYehudim, Kahal means to congregate. A Kahal is a congregation. What's the meaning, simple meaning of congregation? People gathering together in one place. To congregate in one place. That is a physical unity, where people are unified because they're all doing the same thing at the same time in the same place. There's strength in numbers. That's the Kahal. And that is one aspect of unity, that the people, they know, Dome, Yochid oses ha-mitzvah, maybe Rabim oses ha-mitzvah. There's no comparison where one person does a mitzvah or there's a lot of people doing a mitzvah. So when you have a people congregating together, doing the mitzvahs together, Barovam hadras melech. It's a greater covet to the Rabbam Shalom to have a larger group doing a mitzvah than a smaller group. So that is one aspect of the Tzibur, the idea of a Kahal. People united together physically to do mitzvahs as one powerful group, one powerful congregation. Then there's an Eda. Eda could be that the people are not congregated together. They're scattered all over the world. But they're united in spirit, in goal, in what they testify to. The word Eda either has a connection to the word Edus. We all testify to the same principles and goals. Or I think it could come from the word Ya'ad. If you go to the airport and look at the big board there, where it says in English, destination, in Hebrew it says Ya'ad. Ya'ad means a destination. We all have the same destination. We all have the same principles, values, standards, and goals. So we are united in spirit, even if we are scattered around the world. You don't have to be united in body, you're united in spirit. That's an Eda. An Eda doesn't have to be all together. An Eda has to be with one common mind. Okay. And then there's Yisrael. Kahal, Adas, Yisrael. Yisrael is a different kind of unity. Yisrael is, it says in the Zohar, Yisrael is an acronym. Meaning, if you take the letters of Yisrael and make them the first letters of various words, those words spell out Yisrael. What are the words? Yesh, Shishim, Ribui, Osios, LaTorah. There are 600,000 letters to the Torah. And the first letters of those words spell Yisrael. Yesh, Yud, Shishim, Shin, Ribui, Resh, Osios, Aleph, LaTorah, Lamed. Now the simple meaning of that is that there are 600,000 root souls of the Jewish people. There's more than 600,000 Jews. But we're like clusters of souls. There's 600,000 clusters. And everybody is part of one of those 600,000 clusters. So there's 600,000 root souls of the Jewish people, And there are 600,000 letters in the Torah. And every Jew, every cluster of neshamas has a letter. Beautiful. There's only one big problem. There aren't 600,000 letters in the Torah. So, okay, so you'll tell me gematria is, you know, plus or minus one or two is not a big deal. So how many letters are there in the Torah? 304,588. I think that's the number. That is not plus or minus one or two. It's like half. So unless we have the Reader's Digest condensed version, the Torah is missing a lot. There are not 600,000. Not even, there's about half of that. So it's an obvious question on the Zohar. I know about 11 answers to that question, but I don't think there's any question. If there's no question, you don't need any answers. I'll give you some examples of the answers. One answer is that you have to count also the Targum. The Targum was given. So the Targum doubles the letters almost. So now there's 600,000 letters. Others say you have to count the spaces between the letters. Because the Torah originally was black fire on white fire. That means the background is also part of the letters. In children's books, children's magazines, my time at least, they used to have these optical illusions. And they had a thing that sometimes if you looked at it, it looked like a cup, a Kiddush cup, or it looked like two people looking at each other. Depends if you looked at the white part or the black part. You familiar with that optical illusion? Mm-hmm. So the Torah is made of white and black. So we look at the black letters and think that's a thing, but if you look at the white part, that's also part of it. So you have to add that to. There's a lot of answers like that. But I don't think there's any question. The question would only be if it said, Yesh Shishim Ribui Osios BaTorah. There are 600,000 letters in the Torah. But if it said that, it wouldn't spell Yisrael. It would spell Yisra'ab. In order to spell Yisrael, it has to be Yesh Shishim Ribui Osios LaTorah, not BaTorah. What does that mean? I think what it means is the following. Aside from the 300,000 written letters in the Torah, there are 600,000 more letters that have to be added to the Torah to make the Torah complete. Those are the 600,000 root souls of the Jewish people. And that just echoes another Zohar. There's a Zohar that says, Yisrael, the Oraisa, the Kudsha Baruch Hu Chadu, that the Jewish people and the Torah and the Rabbanim Shem are one. So if you don't connect the souls of the Jewish people to the Torah, it's not complete. So Yesh Shishim Ribui Osios LaTorah. There are 600,000 letters to the Torah, not in the Torah. Yeah, in order for the Torah to be complete, in addition to the 300,000 letters that exist in the Torah, you have to add another 600,000 letters that are the souls of the Jewish people. So that's what it means. And that is the following. I was thinking, still won't have it clear 100%, but my Drosha Shabbos is probably going to be on this onion. There's a difference between the two first unities and the second, and the third, the Yisrael. When it comes to a congregation of people congregated together, they're all doing the same thing. They're doing one mitzvah together, right? They're davening b'tzibur. They're all davening the same davening together, and that's what the strength in numbers. Many people doing the same mitzvah together. People scattered over the world with the same ideals and standards and values and beliefs that unite them. Same thing. But Yisrael, right, is everybody's different. Everybody's like a letter in the Torah. There are 300,000 letters. Everyone's different. And there's not only 27 different letters. The 22 and the 5 end letters. But every letter's different. Because its position makes it different. The Beis in Bereishis is not the same as the Beis in Bara. Because the Beis in Bereishis is preceded by blank. And followed by a Reish, Aleph, Shin, Yud, Tav. And the Beis in Bara is preceded by a word. And followed by a Reish, Aleph. The Beis in anywhere is defined by its position. What comes before it, what comes after it, what sedra it's in, what book it's in. So every letter is unique. No two letters are the same. There, the unity is everybody doing their thing, but doing it in synchronized with everybody else. When you talk about the Kahal and the Eda, everybody's doing the same thing, either together physically or together mentally. But in Yisrael, not everybody's doing the same thing. Everybody's a different letter. And every letter is special, and every letter has to be in its specific place in order to be significant. Except all these different letters unite to make a Torah. And I was thinking in the Mishkan, there were three trumos, three things they donated. Two of them were the same for everybody, and one was different. They gave silver for the Adonim, a machsa shekel. Everybody gave the same amount, and it went for the Adonim for the foundation of the Mishkan. The foundation is like the physical unity. You need people to be together to be a nation. The foundation of the nation is the fact that we're all together doing the same thing together. That's the physical foundation of the Mishkan, and there everybody was equal. Then they gave another machzah shekel for the karbanos. Everybody had the same idea. There's a spiritual connection. Not everybody's standing together, but the karbanos that are being made for everybody equally. And they all gave an equal amount, machzah shekel. But when they came to the third truma, there, some people gave zohav, some kesef, some nechoshes, tcheles, argaman, tola ashoni, 13 different things. That third truma was keneged Yisrael. That already is everybody's different. Everybody's a letter to themselves, unique. Everybody donates what they can, as much as they can, different than people giving something different and a different amount. So there are three kinds of unity. There's the kahal, there's the Eda, and there's Yisrael. Two of them are the kind of unity that is, everybody's the same. And the third one, everybody's unique. And everybody contributes their unique part. That's the difference between them, and it corresponds to the donations to the Mishkan. Two of them were the same. Everybody did the same thing. Gave the same thing. One was for the physical foundation of the Mishkan, the other one for the spiritual korbanos, and the third one was everybody gave what they could give uniquely of theirs, and everybody doing it for the same purpose, but each one doing their unique part. That's the three kinds of unity. Okay, any questions on that? That's okay. Next. The Meshech Chachma points out, and this is something that we did a few weeks ago. I don't expect you to remember it, so I will go and review it quickly, but it's an extension of that. We mentioned a few weeks ago that there were two purposes to the Mishkan. One was that there's an idea of motions creating emotions. First you have to go through the motions, and then you get to the emotions. So it's the purpose of the externals that bring you to the internals. And then, once you have those internal feelings, there's another idea of projecting them externally and putting them into something concrete. Okay? So we said that before the Chet HaEgel, the major purpose of the Mishkan was a second purpose. Not to generate a feeling of God's presence, because that you could get anywhere in the world. But once you have that feeling anywhere, you came to the Mishkan to express it in a concrete way through the Kalim of the Mishkan. After the Chet HaEgel, you couldn't come to a feeling of God's presence without a Mishkan. So you needed to come to the Mishkan first to generate that feeling, and then to express it. Okay. It's interesting. The Meshech Chachma points this out. I'm going to say a little bit different than he says, but he points out the idea. In last week's Sedra in Kisisa, the Mishkan, let's start with this week's Sedra. In this week's Sedra Vayakel, the Torah speaks first about Shabbos and then about the Mishkan. And we learn a halacha from that. That Shabbos takes precedence over the Mishkan. You don't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. Because since it mentions Shabbos first and then the Mishkan, Shabbos takes precedence over the Mishkan. You don't build the Mishkan. Adrabah, what was the things that went into building the Mishkan are things you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. But in last week's Sedra, the Torah also spoke about the Mishkan and Shabbos, and it put Shabbos after the Mishkan. Says the Meshech Chachma, it would seem to imply that if all we had was Parshas Kisisa, where Shabbos came after the Mishkan, then we'd say that you could build the Mishkan on Shabbos. Just the opposite. That the Mishkan takes precedence over Shabbos. And you could build the Mishkan on Shabbos. So I was thinking that it fits beautifully what I said. In Kisisa, it's before the Chet HaEgel, where it mentions that. And we said the purpose of the Mishkan before the Chet HaEgel was not to create a feeling of God's presence, but to express that feeling in the Mishkan. After the Chet HaEgel, you needed the Mishkan to create a feeling of God's presence. Why don't we build the Mishkan on Shabbos? Same reason we don't wear tefillin on Shabbos. Because Shabbos is an oath. Shabbos is a sign of God's connection to the world and to Jewish people. Right? And tefillin is an oath that God is connected to us. If you'd wear tefillin on Shabbos, it would decrease the oath of Shabbos. Because why do I need to feel God's presence from the tefillin? I feel it from Shabbos. So putting on tefillin on Shabbos is an affront to the Shabbos. Because why do I need to feel God's presence by putting on tefillin? Don't you feel God's presence from Shabbos itself? So we don't wear tefillin on Shabbos. The same thing would have gone, which goes for not building the Mishkan on Shabbos. If the purpose of the Mishkan is to make you feel God's presence, then building the Mishkan on Shabbos would be an affront to Shabbos. Why do you need a Mishkan to feel God's presence? You have Shabbos. On the other hand, making karbanos in the Mishkan, you do on Shabbos. You light fires, you shech the animals. Why that's okay on Shabbos? Because that's not to create a feeling of God's presence, that's to serve God. Service of God doesn't contradict Shabbos. So you can serve God in the Mishkan on Shabbos and be mechal Shabbos. Do things you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. That doesn't contradict the Shabbos. But doing something that is there to create your feeling of God's presence on Shabbos, what do you need that for? You have Shabbos. So before the Chet HaEgel, when the Mishkan was not to make you feel God's presence, that you got everywhere in the world. It was to express and serve that presence. There was nothing wrong with building the Mishkan on Shabbos. It's only after the Chet HaEgel, where the Mishkan took on a new purpose of creating a feeling of God's presence, now you can't do it on Shabbos anymore, because it's an affront to Shabbos to have to do something that creates a feeling of God's presence, and Shabbos is supposed to do that. So before the Chet HaEgel, you could have built the Mishkan on Shabbos. After the Chet HaEgel, you're not allowed to build the Mishkan on Shabbos anymore. Okay. Another thing about Shabbos in this week's Sedra and last week's Sedra is that in last week's Sedra, the Torah refers to Shabbos as Nekeva, as female. Os hi, mechalaleha, mos yumos. In this week's, it says, kol ha'oseh bo melacha, mos yumos. It refers to the Shabbos as a masculine. So Shabbos is one of the words that can sometimes be masculine, sometimes be feminine. But why? Why is Shabbos sometimes referred to as masculine and sometimes as feminine? So without going into a lengthy discussion, which will take us more time than we have altogether, and make it that we can't speak about anything else, just bekitzer, there are two ideas in Shabbos. One is represented by Shomar and one by Zohar. The Zohar aspect of Shabbos is more the, I think we spoke about this in the other class, way back in the beginning of the year. The Zohar aspect of Shabbos is connected to Zohar, to male. The Shomar is connected to the female aspect. What are these two aspects? Shabbos, on the one hand, teaches me that I am not the boss over here. That I believe that God created the world, and I am not the creator, and therefore I am bound to the design of the creator. and therefore I have to follow what he says. Not because he can zap me with a lightning bolt, not because he's stronger than me, but for a very simple reason. He designed me, and he designed the world. Right? If I bought a car, and it's my car, I can do anything I want with the car. But I like it or not, I am bound to the design of the designer if I want the car to work. I can't put water in the gas tank and expect it to go, because it wasn't designed to run on water, it was designed to run on gasoline. So I am bound to why the person who designed that car, the factory that designed the car, right, made me bound to follow that design if I want the car to go. I can do whatever I want with the car, but if I want it to function, I better do what they designed it to do. If they designed it to run on gasoline and a certain grade of gasoline, I better put that grade of gasoline, otherwise it won't go anywhere, or if it does go, it'll burn out the motor. So if I believe that God designed the world, then I'm bound to his design. And I have to eat what he says I should eat, because that's what he designed me to eat. And I have to wear what he says I should wear, and think what he says I should think, because he designed me. And if I don't do what he says, right, it's not that he's going to punish me. He may do that also, but I'm not going to function. I'm not going to get where I'm supposed to go. So that's what Shabbos tells me. Shabbos says you are not the creator. You have tremendous latitude in this world, but you didn't create the world and you didn't create yourself. And therefore you're bound to the design of the designer. So Shabbos tells me you're not the boss over here. You're just a worker. You're just a created being. Puts me down. Puts me in my place. Yet Shabbos also teaches me that we are partners in God's creation. Because God created a incomplete, unfinished world, and he wants us to perfect it and complete it and finish it off. Asher bara Elohim, God created a world that is not complete. There's a better word for that. And we are supposed to perfect an imperfect world. And we're supposed to perfect it. Tornus Rufus HaRosha once asked Rabbi Akiva, right, what's better, what God makes or what people make? And he expected Rabbi Akiva, of course, to say what God makes is better than what people make. And then he was going to say, well, then we Goyim are better than you Jews. Because we Goyim are the way God made us, and you Jews are the way some Moel made you. So you're not God made, you're people made. So Rabbi Akiva surprised him. He said, of course what people make is better than what God makes. He said, what are you talking about? He said, it's simple. You go home to eat lunch. Your wife made bread and cake. God made wheat. You take your pick, which is better? Right? Bread and cake is much better than wheat. Meaning that God made an imperfect world, a raw materials world, and he expects us to develop it. And therefore what we do is better, because we're the ones who are supposed to develop the world. So we become partners with God in creation. He created a raw materials world, and we're supposed to develop it and bring it to its fruition and complete it and perfect it. So in that respect, Shabbos tells me is Me'ein Olam Haba. We create the world to come through what we do in this world. So we're pretty important people. So on the surface, Zohar v'Shomer seem to be contradictory. But they really are b'dibur echad. If you think you're the creator, you're nothing. But if you understand that you're a created being in the scheme of creation, you're very important. You're the most important part of creation. So Shabbos teaches me we are not the creator. At the same time, in God's mind, we're very important. If we understand that. So they go together. Zohar always represents the giver. It has nothing to do with men and women. Okay? Women can give and men can take. Some men take a lot. Okay? And some women give a lot. And women can take and men can give too. But Zohar and Nekeva is a concept. It's a concept in electricity, in plumbing, right? In the entire world, right? There are the Zohar, the Mashpia, the giver, and the Nekeva is the taker. It obviously has connection to simple male-female relationship, but it goes way beyond that in the world. Okay? So there are male fittings and female fittings in plumbing, electricity, and so on and so on. Okay. And the idea is simple. For Tznius purposes, you can imagine yourself the idea. Okay. In any case. So that's what Zohar. Zohar is the giver, and the Keva is the receiver. Okay. And therefore, Shabbos has both aspects. When Shabbos, the Shomer aspect of Shabbos, okay, is where Shabbos is the receiver, meaning the following. Shomer aspect of Shabbos is the first aspect. You are not the creator. Shabbos is supposed to teach you, right, that God created the world. You do not create the world. Okay, what makes Shabbos significant? If we keep the Shabbos and don't do malacha. When I don't answer the phone on Shabbos, right, that shows that I believe that that phone is not mine. And it's not even Cellcom's or Orange's, it's God's. And if God says, I can't answer it, no matter what the contract says, no matter what I would like to do with this phone that I paid money for, right, it's not mine to do. God has to give me permission to answer it. It's not my phone, it's His. He created the world. He gave me permission to use it, but it's not mine. And the same thing goes with everything else in this world. So therefore, the Shabbos is significant if I keep it. But if I don't keep the Shabbos, the Shomru V'nei Yisrael Shabbos, if we observe the Shabbos, Lasos Es HaShabbos, we make the Shabbos. By not doing Malacha on Shabbos, we make the Shabbos significant. Because if I ignore and I do Malacha on Shabbos, then the Shabbos is useless. It's meaningless. What makes the Shabbos significant? The fact that I observe it and I make the statement that it's not my world. So in the Shomer aspect of Shabbos, the aspect of Shabbos, you're not the creator, by observing that, we make the Shabbos significant. If we ignore the Shabbos, then it has no meaning. So we make the Shabbos. If we make the Shabbos receives from us. It receives its importance from us, and therefore, what's it called? The Shabbos is Nekeva. But on the other aspect, that the Shabbos gives us the idea that it's Me'ein Olam Haba, the Shabbos represents the world to come, and that gives me importance, because we're the ones who create the world to come. Whether I keep the Shabbos or not is irrelevant. The Shabbos is still Me'ein Olam Haba. So the Shabbos then gives me, I'm the receiver. Shabbos is the giver. In that respect, Shabbos is the Zohar. So we have Shabbos as the giver. That's the idea that Shabbos gives me importance, that I create the world to come. Shabbos is like the world to come. And that is irrelevant to me keeping the Shabbos or not. That's a fact. Shabbos is like the world to come. It makes human beings important. But I make the Shabbos important by observing it, and saying that I believe that I'm not the creator. But if I don't observe it, then the Shabbos is insignificant. So from the Shomer aspect, I make the Shabbos by observing it. From the Zohar aspect, the Torah makes me special because it represents Olam Haba. It represents Olam Haba whether I keep it or don't keep it. So in one respect, Shabbos is the receiver, and in the other respect, Shabbos is the giver. So sometimes Shabbos is referred to as Zohar, and sometimes as Nekeva, and most specifically, Friday night is the female aspect of Shabbos. There it's more the Shomer part of Shabbos, because Shabbos at Friday night is called the Kala, Malka, Shabbos Malka, Kala. Shabbos Friday night is the first lesson, you are not the creator here. Shabbos in the morning is the Zohar aspect, the male aspect of Shabbos. There, once you understand you are not the creator, you have to fit into the framework that the creator created, then in the morning, in that framework, you're very important. According to the framework that God made, you're extremely important. You create the world to come. So you're a partner in creation. In that respect, Shabbos is the male. Shabbos gives us that importance. So Friday night, we say in Shemona Esrei, V'yanuchu Vah Yisrael, referring to the Shabbos as female. Shabbos morning and Musaf, we say V'yanuchu Vah, referring to Shabbos as the male. And Shabbos afternoon in Mincha, we say V'yanuchu Bam, because we put them together, because Zohar v'Shomer b'dibur echad. They're not contradictory ideas, they go together. If you understand that you are not the creator, but you have to fit into God's framework, in that framework you're very important. So they go together, and we put them together, Shabbos Mincha time, bom, together. First we go through the bow, the ba, then the bow, and then put them together, bom. Okay. Any questions on that? That was very, very condensed. There's a lot more. I think we did speak about Shabbos at the beginning of the year. I'm almost sure. In the other class. Okay. In much more detail. Okay. Next. But there's so many things in the Sedra, so let's go to something else. Something else also that's a continuation of something we mentioned 2 weeks ago. And again, I don't expect you to remember it, so I will repeat briefly. We said that giving tzedakah supporting Torah is more for the sake of the supporter than the one who's being supported. The Aron carried the people who carried it. When you give tzedakah, the main purpose is for your zechus, not for the sake of the Ani, because God could give the Ani the money. As Chazal say, Yosur Mimashe Ha'Oni, Osir Ma'Oni, more than the rich man does for the poor man does for the rich man. Because the rich man only gives the poor man money. God can give him the money. Cut out the middle man. But the poor person gives the rich man a schus. That only he can give him. God can't give him that because I call bidei shemayim chutz miyira shemayim. So, with that I want to explain the problem with the Nesiim. It says the Nesiim brought in the end the stones and the Ketores, and the Shemen HaMishcha. Three things. But they waited to see what the Jewish people would bring, and they said, whatever they don't bring, we'll make up the deficit. And they were punished for that. Usually you learn because they weren't Zrizim. They should have jumped in and done. But what was the problem? If they had, in the end, not brought anything is one thing, but they brought very expensive things. And because of that, their punishment was a Yud was left out of their name. Nesiim is missing a Yud. What's the connection? So I was thinking simply, there were 13 things they donated to the Mishkan, 13 different kinds of things. Of those 13 things, the Nesiim brought 3 of them. How many didn't they bring? 10. So a Yud is messed out of their name. They missed out on giving 10 of the things. But I have a deeper idea, and that's the following. What was the sin of the Nesiim? Because they didn't jump in right away. Right? In the end, they gave very, very expensive things. So what was the problem? The problem was their whole approach was treif. What did they say? Look, we'll wait and see what the Jewish people bring, and whatever they don't bring, we'll make up the deficit. What deficit? It's absurd. Right? God says, look, I want to build a Mishkan. I need your help. Could you please donate some things? What does God need us to donate anything? Create, you know, all the things you need for the Mishkan. Bring it from who knows where, from Africa, from whatever, and deposit it on the Midbar and say, okay, now here's the materials, go build the Mishkan. And God doesn't even need us to build the Mishkan. He could build the Mishkan. What does he need us to build it for? It says the third Beis HaMikdash is going to come down ready-made. God couldn't build the Mishkan. He needed us to build it for him. He couldn't, he needed us to donate materials for building a Mishkan. He couldn't create the materials, give them to us. What? The answer is obvious, that it was for our sake. He wanted us to donate them, not because he needed the materials. Hey, could you spare some gold and silver? I really need it so I could build the Mishkan. It's absurd. The Rebbeinu wanted to give us the schus. There's no deficit, right? Whatever's the deficit, we'll make up. What kind of deficit? There's no deficit. God has everything. He wants us to have the schus. They didn't understand that. They thought that they were doing, they're making the deficit. That's for their purpose to give. Not that they're the receivers, that the purpose of giving is that they should get the schus. If they would have understood to get the schus, they would have jumped in the beginning. There's no deficit. But they understood, we're making up a deficit. We're doing it for God's sake. We're giving God some gold and silver. That's absurd. That's why they're missing a yud. The word Nesiim with a Yud means those who carry others. Nisim. But without the Yud, you can change the vowels and it can become Nisa'im, those who are being carried. You think you're carrying? You're not carrying, you're the ones who are being carried. Your schos in carrying others is not because they need you. God can carry them. God can give the materials. The reason that you are given the schos to carry is because it's carrying you, because you're getting the schos. So don't consider yourselves nesiim, carriers. Consider yourselves nisa'im, the people who are being carried. Just like the aron. The people who carried were actually being carried to show this idea. People who support Torah are supporting themselves. Torah supports you. You don't support it. The Rabban Shem gave you the schus to support the Torah. You could have a schus. You can be supported. So the whole outlook of the nesiim was treif. What do you mean we're making up a deficit? There is no deficit. It's not for the sake of the Mishkan. God needs your gold and silver. And whatever's missing, you'll make up. You'll give him. He can give you everything. He wants you to have the schus, so jump in. And therefore, don't consider yourselves nesiim. Consider yourselves nisa'im. That's how it can be read without the yod. Okay. Next. The Kli Yoker points out something very interesting about the Mishkan. The Mishkan was like a mini version of the universe. Everything in the Mishkan corresponded to both to the macrocosm and microcosm. The macrocosm is the big universe. The microcosm is a person who's also a little universe. We're a little, every human being, every Jew is a little world. And everything in the Mishkan corresponded to everything that's in the universe and everything that's in a human being. Right? The Aron was like the heart, and the menorah like the head, and so on. All the shulchan was like the digestive system. All different kinds of symbolisms between the universe and the human being. Microcosm, macrocosm. And in that respect, the Mishkan had a lot of things similar to creation of the world. The Kli Yoker points out two things. They're very interesting. It says the Rabban Shem originally created the world b'midas hadin, and then he added rachamim. So we find in the first psukim, Bereshis bara Elokim midas hadin. And then when the Torah reviewed Maisa Bereshis, b'yom bara Hashem Elokim, he added Hashem, mercy, rachamim to din. Who made the Mishkan? Bezalel and Ohaliyav. Which Shevet did Bezalel come from? Yehuda. Yehuda is Yud Kei Vav Kei with an extra Dalet. Shem Shel Rachamim. Hashem. Don, right, is Eliyav, is Din. So the Rabban Shem created the world with Din and Rachamim. He created the Mishkan from Shevet Don and Shevet Yehuda, which is a symbol of Din and Rachamim. Don and Yehuda is Yud Kei Vav Kei. Another thing we see similar is, it says, what's it called, Vayichulu Hashemayim V'Aretz, when the world was finished, and in next week's Sedra it says, Vayichal HaMalacha, and God blessed the world on Shabbos, and Moshe Rabbeinu blessed the people when they finished the Mishkan. There's a lot of parallels. An interesting parallel, says the Kli Yoker, is, when God created the world, he had to say Shakai, Sha'omar Lolomo Dai. The world was expanding and expanding until the Rabban Shem said stop. And the Mishkan was the same thing. In this week's Sedra it says they donated to the Mishkan and they gave so much that the workers had to come and say enough, stop. Don't bring any more. It was expanding and expanding until they said stop. It's exactly what happened with the world. Says the Kli Yoker, why was the world created like that? Why did God create the world in such a way that it expanded and expanded until he said stop? Because here again, the larger world is a symbol to the smaller world. Human beings have to know when to say stop. If we don't control ourselves, we'll expand and expand into areas that are not proper. So when the Rabban Shem created the universe, he created in such a way that there is a time to say stop. To put boundaries. And that's how a person has to be by himself. The Mishkan was the same thing. Since the Mishkan is a parallel to the universe and to the human being, it also was created in such a way that it was expanding and expanding until they said stop. Because that is what the world is all about, creating boundaries. Shakai, right? If you don't create boundaries, things will expand to a point where they're negative. So you have to know when to say stop, when to put those boundaries in. It applied to the world, it applies to the small world of a human being, and applied to the Mishkan, which corresponds to both of those things. Okay, what else can we do here? Something interesting about the Kruvim. The Kruvim were the place where God's presence devolved in the Mishkan. There's all different explanations of what the Kruvim represented. The Rambam says the Kruvim represented Malachim. God's presence devolves on the Malachim or from the Malachim. But Chazal say that the Kruvim, one was male and one was female. One was a male face and one was a female face. And it says also, though, that they were the faces of children. One of the Kruvim was male, one was female, and they had the faces of children, which symbolizes a whole family. You have a father and mother and the children. Then the faces are the children, and the bodies are male and female. And that corresponds to what Chazal say, Ish v'isha shchina shruya b'nehem. That where is the shchina in Klal Yisrael? Not in the Mishkan. It's v'shachanti b'socham, right? And in the heart of every Jew, but more specifically, the shchina is in the Jewish home. The Jewish home is husband, wife, and children. So in the Mishkan, where was the shchina represented? Mibein shnei akruvim. What was the symbolism of the kruvim? Family. So where is the shchina in Klal Yisrael? Ish v'isha shchina shruya b'neihem. The shchina resides between a husband and wife, between a Jewish home, a Jewish family. That's where the shchina really is. And the symbolism was that between the Kruvim, that's where the shchina appeared, that's where the Rabban Shem spoke from, and that represented the family. That's one aspect of the Kruvim, it's a symbol to the Jewish family. That's why the Beis HaMikdash, Avraham Avinu referred to the Beis HaMikdash as a har, as a mountain. Har Hashem Yeroya. Har HaBayis. Yitzchak Avinu referred to the Beis HaMikdash as a soda. Vayetze Yitzchak Lasuach Basoda. And Yaakov referred to it as a bayis. Ein zekim beis elokim. We don't refer to it as Har HaMikdash or Sdei HaMikdash, but Beis HaMikdash. Because Avraham Avinu, I think, saw the Mikdash, his relationship to God was as an individual, like a mountain. You go up the mountain, you're all, what's it called, separate from everybody else. Avraham Avinu, Echad Hoya Avraham, Avraham Avinu came to God on his own, as an individual. Yitzchak Avinu was the first couple, because he was the first shidduch of a Jew, right? So Avraham Avinu got married before he was Jewish. But Yitzchak Avinu was the first one to marry a zug. That's like a field. A field is a fertile place where you work on the field and it produces. That's like a husband and wife. It's like a fertile field. A bayis, though, is a family. Yaakov Avinu was the first Jewish family. 12 tzaddikim, what's it called? Yaakov Avinu built Beis Yisrael, Beis Yaakov. So therefore, the Avraham Avinu saw the Mikdash, his relationship to Hashem as an individual. Yitzchak saw it as a couple. And Yaakov Avinu saw it as a home, as a family. And that's how we refer to it, our relationship to the Mikdash, to Hashem, through the Mikdash is through the family. That's where the relationship is.